I'm Mary Fitzgerald, the Editor-in-Chief of Open Democracy. This is an interview I did with Jacori Arthur as part of our documentary podcast on the US election. Jacori is soon to be the youngest member ever elected to the City Council of Louisville in the state of Kentucky. He's also a professor and musician. I spoke with him in the car as my colleague Aaron and I were driving across Ohio on the way to Kentucky. I began by asking him what it was like growing up in Louisville and how that shaped his decision to run for office.
So I am Jacori, born, raised, still living in the west end of Louisville, which is the highest concentration of Black people in the entire state. I'm also known as 1200, a recording artist, a composer, an organizer as well in the arts. Also known as Mr. Arthur when I'm teaching in schools, community centers, libraries. Also known as Professor Arthur at Simmons College of Kentucky, which is our state's first college specifically for Black people to get a higher degree. A higher education degree. And as you just said, I'll be Councilman Jacori Arthur come January. Growing up in Louisville, oftentimes people say it's the tale of two cities. And that is really at the local level defined as the 9th Street Divide, which is really just the wealth gap. And people say the racial wealth gap, but it's less about race and more about lineage. And it's about a lineage of people who are descendants of slaves and descendants of slaveholders as well. So I represent a movement called ADOS, A-D-O-S, the American Descendants of Slavery. And this has helped me wrap my mind around what it means to be Black in America, because it's not even about being Black. We used to be Negroes, we used to be colored. Now we're considered Black, we're African-American, we're all of these different labels that have never truly made sense. But what has made the most sense to me is just calling us what we are, which is descendants of slaves, which is what Dr. Martin Luther King called us in his final book before he was assassinated. So growing up in Louisville, it has been a reflection of growing up in the United States of America. And I would say Louisville is the perfect place to reflect America. I call Louisville the capital of American racism, because we have these Southern tendencies. We are the gateway to the South, but we are also closer than other Southern cities and other states to the North and to the Midwest. So you have that covert racism, and you have that overt racism. And that is what it has meant growing up in the city of Louisville, having a lack of progress or the illusion of inclusion, but never really having progress and never really having inclusion, just being treated perceived a little bit better than other Southern cities. And that's what it was like for me and what it's like for so many other ADOS people in this city.
So tell me, what was your experience in education? And I was speaking to my dad about busing in the 70s. When did you come into the education system and what was your experience of it?
So I was born in 1992. So, you know, mid to late 90s is when I entered the public school system. And I went to school at an elementary known as Maupin today, but it used to be called Parkland Elementary School. Parkland is the same neighborhood that Muhammad Ali was born and raised in. So it's very significant to Louisville and very significant when you think about what's been happening recently as far as the protests go, because, you know, a little bit over 50 years ago, Parkland was the center of protests that occurred in the late 60s. About a month after Dr. King was assassinated, there was some police violence that occurred. And upon that officer who was the culprit in that attack, there were protests because he was released, because he was about to be let off easy, just as we've seen the officers who killed Breonna Taylor get let off. And the National Guard was called to come here and calm people down, really mostly Black people down. They ended up killing two Black teens. And we just saw over the summer, they were called here again and they ended up killing someone. So Parkland is significant because it was the peak of the civil rights era in terms of what revolution really is, which is bloodshed to bring about change. Any revolution that's taken place from here to France, to Germany, anywhere, it's brought about change through bloodshed. And that bloodshed occurred, unfortunately, because we are who we are and the socioeconomic is imbalanced. We didn't see long-term change. And really, that's what opened up the door for people like Michael Newby, a black man, to get shot in the back and killed back when I was 11 years old. That's what opened up the door for Shelby Gazaway to get shot and killed. That's what opened up the door for Breonna Taylor to get shot and killed. So this is all connected. Our history is never really gone. It's a through line. But when I'm growing up in school, I didn't know this. I didn't know that Maupin, who our school was named after, Milburn T. Maupin, was the first of his kind to be elected into certain political positions as an alderman, or the first of his kind to become someone who was hired in central office with our public schools. This wasn't taught to us. It wasn't taught to us that Muhammad Ali was from that same neighborhood. It wasn't taught to us any of this history. In fact, when you look at Black history across the country, 7% or less is taught within our schools. So I didn't get that experience then, and I'm learning it late now, but I've made it my mission as a teacher today to make sure other students don't fall through the cracks and get the same disservice of an education that I received when I was a student there.
Thank you. I wanted to ask about the Breonna Taylor tragedy and killing that happened. What did this mean for the people of Louisville? What did this signify?
It signified a lot for the ADOS community. It wasn't shocking. The killing itself wasn't shocking. The response to the killing wasn't shocking. And the verdict, and I use verdict loosely just to say the decision made not to prosecute the officers for murder was not shocking. This has happened for centuries. Over and over and over, specifically with our police department, who in this city were created, formally organized to patrol and maintain and regulate the slave population. So Black people in the city back then, and they're doing more of the same today. We have over 1,100 officers. Only 12 of them have addresses in the predominantly Black area of town in the west end of town. And Breonna Taylor is a result of that policing, is a result of them being created as Klansmen to hunt us down, to maintain and regulate and patrol and bring us back to plantations or slave dens or pens. She is a result of that. She descends from those ancestors who were dealing with the same terror centuries ago when Louisville was founded. So there's no shock from us. The shock, for the most part, has happened across town. It has happened across the racial cafeteria, if you will, of white people who are just now seeing for the first time the ugliness of racism in this country. And don't get me wrong, it's not like most of us are lacking sensitivity to the situation, but there are some white people who have never had it hit home in the way that it has hit home until you see us expressing ourselves in the streets, marching in front of these news cameras, having these conversations about race that have never been had before. And if they have, you might have heard, but you didn't listen. And today we are seeing people listen in totally different ways. Now, unfortunately, I'll be the bearer of bad news and say that that listening is in many cases not resulting in anything anyway. You might be listening, but it doesn't mean that you're going to do something about what you just heard or what you just listened to. And I'm here as an elected official, as the youngest ever in Louisville's history, as the blackest, and some people say as the prettiest, to make sure that we do something about what we're talking about, what we're talking about in this interview, what we see happening across the city, across this country. I'm here to make sure that something happens, to be accountable for making it happen, because we have not had that. Post Dr. King being assassinated. It's almost like we fell asleep as a country on race relations and the progress of our group specifically.
So you were just saying that you're going to make sure that stuff happens and as a result of this moment. Can you say a bit more about what you're going to be focused on trying to make happen?
So local, it's legislation. It's not only writing the laws, new ones, but also writing the laws, as in correcting laws that have been written to wrong us. And even though you look around our downtown area and the colored only, whites only signs don't exist, the intent still very much so exist. And you can see by just the interaction, engagement, who's welcome and who's not welcome, who is participating, who is a consumer, who is an owner in the way that this city functions. And it's important for us to have that understanding so we can change what has been really just this inequity that has existed since the beginning of this city was founded and has never been addressed, never been fixed, never been corrected. And that starts with our Black elected officials having a formal caucus, a formal organized body to address these concerns, to address these inequities, and also having a formal legal political document, a Black agenda that is going to help guide us down this path of justice for us, because the justice isn't just about bad policing or bad police. The justice is about us owning homes. The justice is about us having wealth. The justice is about making sure that our schools are adequate, just like the schools across town. The justice is multidimensional, and it has to be because it's multi-generational injustice that we have experienced. That's local. Federal, what I'm working on through the ADOS movement is reparations. And that is the only factor when it comes to really closing the lineage wealth gap that we have been on the bottom of since our existence here and since we were so-called emancipated here in 1865. The wealth gap is almost $100 trillion wide. It is the worst it has ever been in history today. And if we don't do something about it, if we don't do anything about it, our wealth will shrink to zero. Our jobs will be wiped out of existence because of automation that is happening and has been accelerated with COVID-19 and people working and going to school from home. We won't exist without reparations in a country that we built. So local is legislation, national is reparations.
I also wanted to paint the picture of local and statewide politics in Louisville and in, across the state in Kentucky. Now, Mitch McConnell is known outside of the United States. You know, we're watching what happened with the Supreme Court and the Republican dominance of the Senate and the judiciary. And that story has really traveled. And one of the reasons I'm keen to tell the story of Kentucky, you know, and Louisville in the center of it is also to explain how a figure like Mitch McConnell can exist, because I think that tells a story about America too. And so I wondered if you could, I guess, talk me through what, let's start this way. What does Mitch McConnell mean to you? What presence has he been in your life and in the lives of the people in your city? And how is he able to keep on winning elected office in the state of Kentucky?
I would say Mitch McConnell is one and the same with Amy McGrath, who's running against him. And you're not going to hear really anybody say that outside of someone who's aligned with this reparative, restorative justice that I'm aligned with. Because when I think of people in Congress, I immediately think of what I just discussed, which is reparations and the fact that they can push this to happen up through the president's office. Mitch McConnell on record does not support reparations for slavery or segregation. And Amy McGrath, the woman running against him, has said yay or nay, which is really just saying nay. So when I think of Mitch McConnell, a lot of people, you know, shame and blame him as if he's the devil and he's the worst politician of all time. But what you have to understand for someone who's Black, who's ADOS in this country, is that really all of these politicians are one and the same. I call the left wing and the right wing two wings of the same bird. The only difference is the Republicans appear to be a little bit more harsh, a little bit more sharp-tongued. They'll probably shoot you, but the Democrats are a little bit more witty and cunning. They might just stab you in the back. So I'm sure that's not the answer you were expecting or looking for, but I really don't see a difference between a Mitch McConnell and an Amy McGrath.
I wasn't expecting or looking for any particular answer. And I think what you said is really interesting. I think I would ask the same question, which is Mitch embodies a power elite, which can be both Republican and Democrat, the way that you describe it. a system which keeps producing the same winners who have the same policies. And I'm curious to know, I suppose, how and why you think that keeps happening.
Well, when you have an elite class, you have people in power, people with wealth who are in a certain place, aka the top of society, fixing a group that's at the very bottom of society, not only does it require work, but it also makes you acknowledge an atrocity that has occurred and helped you benefit to get to where you are. And Mitch and whatever other politician that's in the same boat that he's in, they aren't ready to make those vulnerable admittances. They aren't ready to deal with that truth, because that truth is so ugly, and it will force them to look in their own mirrors and reflect how they got to where they are. And what it will do as an end result is all of a sudden it puts us in standing to be a part of that same elite class. And when you've existed for so long, sitting on top of everyone else, exploiting everyone else, I think there's a sense of fear in not wanting people to be where you are. There's a sense of fear because it makes you less special. It takes away some of that power that you have and puts you in a position of true equality that we've never had ever. And him being as old as he is, I would say that scares him. And therefore, him and the powers that be that are also in the same position as him work together to maintain this injustice, to maintain this inequity. It's socially engineered. It's supposed to be this way, according to them.
So you've very powerfully explained what's motivating the elites who hold power. But they're not big, right? Their number is not large in terms of numbers of people, right? There are both black and white people in Kentucky and across the country who are poor, who suffer injustice, and yet you see a lot of white people in Kentucky voting for leaders like Mitch McConnell. You see, I guess what I'm saying is that if people had, in many ways, their own self-interest at heart, how can you imagine, why do they keep electing these elites that have these motivations, that have these self-interest, that have these vested interests?
I can't and could never speak for a white person in Eastern Kentucky that votes for Mitch McConnell. They vote for their interests just like I vote for mine. And I think it's a disservice when we play ourselves and we're naive to think we can align on certain subjects or certain interests to a certain extent. Of course, there are people who are white who are wealthless in some cases, but when you look at the average, the collective of people across this country who are black and white, who are descending from slaves versus who are descending strictly from the slaveholders, what you see is that on average, black households with a head who has a college degree have less wealth than a white household who doesn't even have a high school diploma. And that's just based on the numbers alone. And that's just based on the fact that the Federal Reserve shares this information with economists, and then they share the information with their following, and then I stumbled along it. So I can't speak for someone who votes that way. Just like I can't speak for black people in the 1920s, where we were overwhelmingly voting Republican. There were over 25,000 registered black voters in this city in 1921, 99. And I'm not making that number up, 99% of them were registered as Republicans. But over the course of time, we saw interest change. We saw the Democratic Party, President Lyndon B. Johnson, provide something of substance for black people, the Voting Rights Act, the Fair Housing Act, the Civil Rights Act. We vote for our interest. And I believe anyone who votes for Mitch McConnell is voting for what they believe to be their interests. And I'm nobody to tell them what their interests are or are not. So I can't speak to that.
This election has been all about Trump, right? It's the media coverage, the discussions. It's been all about Donald Trump. What do you actually think about Joe Biden?
Joe Biden wreaked havoc on black families across this country when he not only helped write and advocate it, but also helped pass the 1994 crime bill. There are more black men today in prison in this country than there are women in prison on the entire planet. And that is in part to Joe Biden's work on that crime bill. So I will never forgive him for that. I will never forget that. But as I said earlier about Mitch McConnell and Amy McGrath, again, he is not an advocate for reparative justice, which is exactly what we need. He's not even willing to repair that mistake. And he has on record said multiple times that he does not regret that decision. He does not regret that policy. And when you look at his running mate, it's more of the same, you know, setting records for locking up black men in the state and also locking up black women for so-called truancy and situations that had root causes that were never addressed. So when I think of a Joe Biden, going back to what I said about the two wings of the same bird, you know, I really look at how people are trying to tap into black people's emotions and talk about Trump being so racist. Well, if Trump is racist for something that he's done the past few years or something that he said the past few years, how racist is Joe Biden for something that he has said and something that he has done for the past few decades? That's what people have to swallow, and the truth that they have to realize in this upcoming election. And therefore, and I say this as a registered Democrat and as a candidate and a voter, therefore I'll be voting down ballot unless either one of them comes with some sort of reparations plan and a black agenda. There's no way in the world I would ever vote for a Joe Biden who called my father, my uncles, not only out of their names and called them super predators and said they needed to be removed from society, but turned around and locked them up and took them away from their households. That's how I feel about Joe Biden.
If you've thought about this much or at all, how do you think the rest of the world sees this election? People outside of the United States, what do you think their perspectives are, and what would you say to them? What do they need to understand?
I think people don't understand. I'll talk about what they don't understand, and I'll say what they need to understand. I don't think that they understand the reality of our lives in this country. I know what people see overseas, and I've been overseas several times. What they see are the mass media and the super coverage, I would say, of black people who are successful, who visit their countries, who are entertainers or athletes and otherwise. They see that, and it almost creates this sense of just, I would say, misidentification for who we are. And going back to being ADOS, even those people who are so-called wealthy and so-called celebrities, they are for the most part ADOS. And their families don't live the lives that they live. So people fail in their understanding of this country by thinking that we, who aren't related to them, live the life that they live. And that creates a situation where there's a lack of urgency for something like reparations, or a lack of urgency and understanding for us voting for a president who locked up so many black people, who wreaked havoc on black families. People don't understand that. And I've had conversations with international media plenty, whether it's, you know, CBC or BBC. And I would say, as unbiased as they're supposed to be, they're very shocked and my stance and the way that I talk about politics, because they have only taken the anecdotes that they want to take. And there's this sensationalism around Donald Trump being a horrible person without looking at the other person and realizing that they are also equally, if not more, horrible. And that has been such a disservice to the work that we're trying to do, because it creates this opportunity for criticism. But you're criticizing something you have no understanding of, not only because you're getting media in a very filtered, edited way that has a specific narrative and intent, and you've also never lived this experience, and you don't live in the inequity that we live in, which is the largest racial wealth gap in history. That's what's misunderstood. And I would say any of that should be understood, but it would take you being here and being from this lineage to understand that.
there's been a lot of speculation and concern over what might happen on polling day. And actually, I wonder if, before we talk about what could happen this election and at the polls, if you could tell me a little bit, of, and again, explain to an international audience what's happened with voter disenfranchisement. Because, of course, there's a narrative that this is something that happened and that it was fixed in the 60s, which, of course, is not the case. So bring us up to speed about what's been happening with voter disenfranchisement and suppression in your experience and in Louisville and Kentucky.
Well, the way that voting has taken place countrywide in the United States of America has largely been a failure because there is a lack of cohesion. And what I mean by that is when you look at something as simple as polling places on election day, across the country, there is no consistency in when those polling places close. In Kentucky, we are one of a handful of states that close at 6 o'clock in the evening. And if you're at work until 5 and you got to drive across town in rush hour traffic and you got to pick up kids from after school activities or anything else, it's going to be quite difficult for you to make your vote count if you can't put your vote in a ballot box, if you can't cast your vote. Now, to alleviate COVID-19 concerns, there has been a new method of voting that many people have never partaken in before, which is, you know, voting by an absentee ballot or voting by mail. Keep in mind, this was created because of COVID-19. It was not created to help anyone who was struggling to get to the polls because they closed early. And that's problematic. And even with COVID-19 being a reason that people can vote by mail, we've seen a lack of cohesion as far as whose ballot is counted versus whose ballot is thrown out. We've also seen a lack of cohesion as far as who gets a second chance to correct their ballot in case there's a mistake versus whose ballot just gets thrown out and they don't get a second chance. We've seen an information segregation era where if you don't have access to the internet or a computer or a smart device, it's harder for you to sign up for your absentee ballot. In Kentucky, we saw really just this hodgepodge of people trying to get to their ballots any way they could. And a system that wasn't proactive about how that process was going to take place, a number that was inactive and people weren't keeping up with it, and you couldn't leave messages. And this is for the people who don't have internet access. We saw a lack of leadership, proactive leadership, when it came to voting in the middle of this global pandemic. And that has been problematic. We just had a primary in June and over 15,000 ballots were thrown out. And that could have altered the race. Amy McGrath might not even be running against Mitch McConnell right now if those 15,000 or so ballots got a second chance in the same way that some got a second chance and some were supposed to get a second chance. So there's inconsistencies. And of course, this is on top of all of the disenfranchisement that we've already had occur. In Kentucky, there was this back and forth about having people show certain government issued IDs when branches are closed during COVID-19, how are you supposed to make that happen? There's just really so many layers of issues when it comes to voting that have taken place in Kentucky and across the country, really.
Thank you. I'm going to ask you about Charles Booker now. So can you tell me the platform he ran on, what he was advocating, and how you think he would have fared against Mitch McConnell?
So Charles is who I alluded to when I said we would have a different person running against Mitch if those ballots were treated equally and fairly. And what makes Charles special to me personally is that he lives around the corner from me. And he lives in a neighborhood known as Russell in the West End community, you know, a historically Black community that used to be called the Harlem of the South at one point, that housed over 150 Black businesses. This was the place to be if you were Black in the city of Louisville for almost a century. Unfortunately, Russell has faced so much disinvestment and so much neglect over the course of time. We are home of the highest poverty rate in the city of Louisville, 52.7%. So over half of our residents are suffering from being financially challenged and living in this poverty. And when you not only come from that type of neighborhood, but you live in that type of neighborhood, you are going to be a different type of politician like I am. You're not going to just talk about issues from a third person perspective. You're going to talk about issues from a first person perspective because you live the life of your constituents. You are your constituents. And Charles was his constituents. And when I heard him talk, I felt like I was talking to a cousin or I was talking to a brother. I was talking to somebody who was in my family. So he connected with voters in a way that I believe they have never been connected with before. And that's also a huge difference between him and the woman who's running against Mitch now. And I believe if Charles was in the race currently, he would be giving Mitch some issues and Mitch would be terrified to run against someone who has not only had the message, but also had the mobilization of bringing people together to push Kentucky forward, the entire state. But him being from where he's from is so significant and so just vital to the race that he ran. And it made him who he is. And it's definitely going to take him far in life. I wish he was running against Mitch right now.
Whoever wins on November 3rd, presidency, what's the first thing you'd like them to see them do? What's the thing you would want your next president to tackle on day one?
You know, what's funny about that is these presidents, I've heard Joe Biden say it a lot. I've heard Kamala Harris, his VP, say it a lot. They talk about what they'll do day one. And I've yet to hear anyone talk about what they would do day one for us. And we built this country. I can't say that enough. This country is the richest and powerful country ever because of the free labor and the stolen land from indigenous people and the stolen bodies from black people, from us. And I haven't heard anyone say anything about day one, this is what we would do. And that is exactly why I'm voting down ballot, until they commit to doing something. And it's not even just about day one. It's like long-term. This is going to be a multi-generational effort when it comes to repairing the American descendants of slavery. And no one is speaking to our needs. No one has an agenda specifically designed for us. They got a whole lot of class-based, a whole lot of minority people of color policies that don't do anything for us. And that's problematic. So day one, I would hope that they implement a reparations package and a black agenda, but they haven't talked about it before the election. So I definitely can't trust them to do it after they, you know, potentially win the election. Furthermore, their political history does not show that they would ever do anything like that in the first place. So I have no expectations from either of the candidates.
Is there anything else you want to tell me? Like, you know, what else would you want to speak to a global audience? What do you think's missing? What do you think people outside this country need to hear about 2 days before election day?
I would encourage anyone to do their own research, discover their own findings as far as who these candidates are, the differences between them. Something that Trump often gets called, as we talked about earlier, is racist. And if you look at Joe Biden's career as a politician, he's just as racist. Trump gets called xenophobic. If you look at Joe Biden, Barack Obama's administration, they set the record for the amount of deportations of immigrants in this country. It's not even close. They built the cages that people criticize Trump for putting kids into. When you unpack both of these candidates, you realize Trump has been terrible for almost 4 years. Joe Biden has been terrible for almost 47 years. So you have to come to that understanding before you criticize anyone for practicing their right and voting or not voting, because both are the rights of people who live in this country. And that is incredibly important. You also have to realize, as people criticize black folk, for not voting for any candidate or voting for a specific candidate, we did not put Donald Trump in office. White people almost at a 60% rate put Donald Trump in office. Registered white voters at a 60% rate voted for Donald Trump, 58 if we want to be exact. And because they did this, it is their responsibility to fix what they broke. So instead of talking to me and other people who are fed up with both of the candidates, you know, they should be talking to their grandparents. They should be talking to their aunts and uncles, their brothers and sisters, their husbands, their wives. Because we didn't put Trump in office, but we are expected to save America, just like we have saved America over and over and over again. And we're not doing that anymore.
What gives you inspiration and hope? You talked about Charles Griffin. I have a feeling we're going to hear a lot more from. And there have been some Democratic candidates in different parts of the country who I think run on a platform or with an agenda that you, what you said, would be agree with. And I think, as you said earlier, there's been a real mobilization this year around racial justice, which obviously draws on much longer roots, but has been taken to the next level. So looking ahead, what gives you hope and what gives you inspiration?
I don't find too much hope in adults. I'm 28, so anyone my age and above. I find hope in something that the greatest abolitionist, who was a runaway slave, once said. He once said that it is easier to build strong children than to repair broken men. And the person who said that was Frederick Douglass. And I live by this and know that our Generation Z, Generation Alpha, are going to bring forth the change that I'm starting a fight for right now. They're going to finish that fight or get further in that fight when they are of adulthood. So they inspire me, they motivate me, they give me hope. My three-year-old gives me hope. The other day we were playing store and he wouldn't even let me shop in his you know, fake toy store unless I wore a mask. That is leadership. And that is leadership that we have adults who aren't even showing in their political practice. So I get hope from Generation Alpha. I get hope for the future of our country because of the wit and the intelligence of the young people, of the teenagers, of the toddlers that we have today. I'm so inspired by them. And that's who I do it for every day when I wake up.